relatively early in the campaign, you know, not to, I did think that he had a serious chance at the nomination. And then by the summer, late summer in August, I was convinced that he was going to win. But at first, I thought it was a joke. I like everybody else in the media, I thought eventually the quote unquote real candidate would emerge. And I think it comes through in the book where in the beginning it's all fun and games and hilarious, and then of course it takes this horrible dark turn in the middle when we realize that this is no joke at all.
In the book, now this reminds me, in the book you describe what would normally happen to a candidate who is a joke and who the press corps thinks is a joke, and you described it as the seal of death, a shunning process. Could you describe the seal of death? And why didn't work on Trump?
Well, and this is something I'm not proud of this, but, you know, some journalist friends of mine and I, you know, on the campaign trail, we talked about this. There's a script for what happens to a candidate who slips up, says something stupid, and proves him or herself to be an inappropriate candidate. And that can be for something as minor as Howard Dean's scream, or it could be the Gary Hart monkey business thing. And we know how this script works in our business. We denounce them with negative reports for a couple of days, then they kind of retreat with the tail between their legs, and then there's a public apology, and then they quietly exit the race a couple of weeks later. That's usually how these things happen, and we kind of expected the seal of death to kind of hold form with the McCain incident, where, you know, Trump said that he liked people who weren't captured, and it went exactly the opposite direction. I think that was a moment. That was a moment of clarity for a lot of reporters, where we realized we were dealing with a different animal.
That was amazing to me because, I mean, it's just the line you don't cross. I'm sure there are plenty of historical examples. Where's the beef? It's in the rice. Sort of jokes like if you have a bimbo eruption, or if you say something that is just so horrible, then you're going to get shunned, and then this process that you described is going to go forward. And I really expected that, and then it bounced off.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the thing that was so crazy about that is that the one thing that you can do, it's like the ultimate sacred cow in electoral politics, is go after veterans. I mean, it's probably more survivable to go outside wearing a white hood than it is to say something negative about veterans, and Trump did it, and he went up in the polls, which was a total shock to all of us.
This book is a fun read, and it's funny, but of course it's about a very serious subject, and you point that out, that there are points at which it just isn't funny anymore. Although I want to quote one of your funnier statements. I think this is from Rolling Stone. Trump is the perfect modern American. He's a human consumption machine with no attention span, no self-control, no beliefs, and no hobbies outside of sex, spending, eating, and talking about himself. And you wrote, Nixon at least played the piano and read classics. He was an intellectual with a pig's heart. Trump is just the pig part. So I guess it's the time in the interview. And I should say, you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch, and I'm talking with Matt Taibbi, who is author of Insane Clown President. And I would like to know what you think about Trump the bully and his emergence from that field of candidates in the primary.
It's extraordinary. Here's the problem. This is the funniest thing that's ever happened in the history of our politics, but it's also potentially the collapse of America as a world. Or does that make it funnier? It was very difficult to know exactly how to cover this whole thing, because there was an element of absurdity that ran through this whole story and continues to run through it. Even this week, you know, even as he's signing his executive orders, you get these stories that come out that say that he's upset because he's not having enough fun in the White House. Like, how could he not know that the job is not about having fun? I mean, this stuff, it's just so hard to have a straight face when you're writing about this and not point out the absurd aspects of it, which of course detracts from the serious response. It's a confounding story.
Oh, I don't know. Surely we can laugh on the way to the grave.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Especially the seriousness of it reminds me that the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists just came out with their 2017 Doomsday Clock statement. Their famous Doomsday Clock. They're moving it up half a minute. The title is "It is 2.5 minutes to midnight," and they mention, maybe not directly. I haven't read the whole thing yet. Trump and Trumpism. It's a horrifying thing. I just before I came in, I looked at Trump being interviewed in Washington Post, and I can see why he didn't give interviews. I mean, he just comes off as so venal, such a repulsive person when his face is right there in the camera, and you get to ask him questions, and he says these things. He constantly redirected the interview to how popular he was, and so it would appear these descriptions of him as a narcissist are entirely correct. Can you talk about his narcissism?
Oh, he's undeniably suffers from narcissistic personality disorder of the most extreme variety. And the evidence for that for me, I mean, there's so many different instances, but just to give an example, something like, Meryl Streep going after him in the Golden Globe speech and Trump not being able to shrug that off. You're the president of the United States and you're so bothered by something that an actress says that you have to tweet it out. I mean, that tells you that this person has literally zero tolerance for criticism. In the wake of an historic victory for the world, but he's still miserable. And I mean, that's characteristic of people who have this condition, which is that there's this bottomless well of rage and insecurity that is never assuaged by any level of success or accomplishment. A lot of people who have narcissistic personality disorder are successful for this reason, because they're constantly driven to get attention, positive attention, but they're never happy. And Trump is exactly that kind of person.
I wouldn't find it reasonable to pick on him for his orange face or his peculiar weave or that sort of thing. I mean, that sort of thing doesn't matter. I mean, I was a Bernie Sanders fan, more or less, and you could say things about Bernie and call him Colonel Sanders and all this stuff and his wispy hair and all that. That just shouldn't matter, but it's something that seems to matter deeply to him, how he is perceived.
Absolutely, and that's really, that's incredibly troubling, because the only thing that matters to Donald Trump is what he perceives you think of him. That's why this whole issue of crowd size was so important to him. I think it's a pretty obvious Freudian angle to that whole problem. And this idea of reinvestigating the voter fraud issue, even after his own lawyers have said in writing that there was no evidence of voter fraud, that has everything to do with him being able to say that he won the popular vote. He wants to, I mean, even issues that he shouldn't be litigating, he's litigating because it's all about his image and what he thinks of himself. And what's worrying about that is that eventually he's going to feel slighted by somebody who has like a nuclear weapon. And that's what's worrying.
That is worrying. Okay. Now that reminds, okay. That's complicated. And now I want to talk about it in terms of Steve Bannon being in the White House. And being the, he's going to be the media man, whether he's called that exactly or not. So here we have Trump. He's narcissistic. He wants to say that the crowds are huge. But then he did this thing. He did this really bald-faced lie. He made his man go out and say the bald-faced lie. Bannon had to know about that. Had to be directing mm-hmm. it at some. Okay, so here's this other level to it. He made his man go out and humiliate himself. Okay, then Trump himself went to the CIA and he said not only that his lie was true, but that he had humiliated the press by proving that, now I'm tripping up on myself, proving that his lie was not a lie, therefore the press is humiliated, therefore he won, and then he repeats the lie. So it seems to me that at some level what's going on, maybe Trump's being used to some level by this, at some level, well, they're dividing the population and saying, here I make the truth. Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, sure. But what's crazy about it is, back in the Bush years when they, we had Bush aides talking about how they're in the reality making business, there was a policy imperative behind that. This is, I think, mostly what's going on right now, again, is trying to soothe Trump's basically constant and relentless need for adulation and praise and reassurance. I think that's going to be a driving concern of the entire White House. Bannon worries me because he's the only person in that whole collection of people that I think has brains and has the ability to come up with a strategy to manipulate Trump in a direction that would be, you know, hugely destructive. Like, in, you know, for implementing some kind of nationwide racialist policy, that he's the only person I can see who would be capable of pulling something like that off.
Yeah, that's where my mind was going with it, because Bannon can take that. I mean, we've got, say, 30% of the population that is, you know, just ugly racist. I mean, that was the shock for me from the election. It's like, why didn't I pay attention to that? I guess it's because as a white person, I don't suffer from it. You know, I can drive down the street. The cops can't read me from a distance as transgender. So I'm just a white person driving a car, and I don't get stopped. When I do get stopped, you know, I keep my voice carefully feminized, and I don't get searched. I don't suffer from this racism as it is expressed through, you know, let's say some cops and protected by all cops. So this caught me by surprise, and this exposed my racist comfort. So I'm thinking that with Bannon in there, this sort of I make the truth thing can create a 30% of the population as shock troops. I mean, he's in that. In that way, as a dictator, he's better off. He's got a better power base than Pinochet had.
Oh yeah, or that Lenin did when he, you know, when he assumed power. I mean, the Bolsheviks were really the Mensheviks. If you know, in reality, they were the minority party. But if you have a base of hardcore dedicated followers, and you have a canny enough political operator, and Bannon qualifies. He's I think, in the Karl Rove school, the Lee Atwater school. He's somebody who understands how American politics works and how the media works, and he understands the modern media landscape. You connect that hardcore racist, you know, part of the population to that kind of mind, and then you add the cult of personality that Donald Trump has, and you could do a lot of damage.
And you do write about how important race is. But, you know, you mentioned Lenin, and I believe you mentioned that there's a Leninist strategy factored in here. I was reading something from the Cato Institute, and they were saying that the Cato Institute, should take a Leninist strategy of building their group while destroying other coalitions in order to destroy Social Security. What did you mean when you say that... Yeah, their coalition was the bankers. They're very clear about it if you read that document.
Well, you know, it's not surprising. But, yeah, I mean, I lived in Russia for a long time. I studied there back when it was still communist. I unfortunately had to take classes in Leninism. And, you know, Steve Bannon has reportedly anyway said that he's a great admirer of Lenin, that he believes and the idea that you need to create chaos before you can, you know, in order.
Well,
and I think he's, you know, they can use Trump to accomplish that kind of aim. And, you know, right now what's going on, they're fracturing and atomizing everybody. And this is a classic Leninist tactic, is to have everybody shouting at each other while you, the determined strategist, plow forward and go after your real goals. And if you look at what's going on in the left right now, everybody's screaming and yelling at each other and debating what's going on and arguing over whether or not the Women's March was, you know, the right strategy and all that stuff. This is all classically the kind of thing that you'd be taking advantage of if you're a Leninist tactician. So, you know, Bannon's bent in that regard worries me a lot, for sure.
So it may be in play already.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and it's not like we haven't had, you know, admirers of Lenin, you know, be major players before. If I remember correctly, Grover Norquist is also one. it's kind of a fetish among sort of campus conservatives to look at the tactics of those revolutionaries, not the politics, but the tactics, and be appreciative of it because it's pure power politics. And there was nobody ever who was more ruthless in their conquest of enemies than these people were. And also, you know, the alt-right movement uses the same kind of language in terms of we're a small, hyper-educated minority that is allied with a larger group of, I love the poorly educated. They talk about the white working class. They think of themselves as the vanguard, as the elite of a movement, and that's also very similar.
Well, now I want to change topics a bit. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and I'm talking with Matt Taibbi, author of Insane Clown President, new book. I want to ask you about the Trump turning the press into villains along with the donor class and winning with that strategy. Losing faith in the conventional media, no common ground for facts. Facts are a consumer choice. In comes Trump. Can you talk about that?
Sure. No, I think that was something that I saw a long time ago. Going back to 2006, I wrote a whole book about how, reporters were starting to see that people were tuning out the mainstream media. They were drifting in more conspiratorial directions. As people were feeling more discontented with the corruption and dysfunction government, and tuning out the kind of mainstream media that they saw as agents of a corrupt system, they were leaning in more and more conspiratorial directions in terms of looking for solutions. And Trump was tapped into that. And the moment that I realized that he had harnessed this was when he started to point to people in the media in the middle of his speeches and turn us into part of his act, almost like a WWF routine. You know, he would say, look at these bloodsuckers, look at these liars, you know, they've never come so far, they hate me, they hate you. And he turned it into an us against them kind of a phenomenon, and it was very, very effective.
That must have been a little scary, I mean, given Trump's tendency to practically hand out baseball bats.
It was a little unsettling, you know, you'd be behind the rope line, and if you've ever been to these events, you know what it's like. You're behind a little chain or a rope line, and there's a bunch of camera riser, and you're sitting there separated by the crowd by not very much. And Trump would kind of direct everybody to turn in your direction and start booing and hissing. And it was a little weird. You know, I mean, he's talking about, the oligarchs who give money to Jeb Bush. And he's talking about the major parties. But we were the only people among his list of elite enemies who were actually in the room. And that was kind of unsettling. He made us the representatives, the face of the conspiracy. And it was really effective. It was brilliant on a level, but it was kind of scary for us, for sure.
Well, now, I don't want to join the circular firing squad, but I do want to talk about the tendency of some major reporters to feel, as you've mentioned, common cause with elites. I mean, is that why Sanders got 23 times less coverage? Isn't it a self-fulfilling prophecy to deny Sanders coverage and then say Trump was better at getting ratings? And, you know, what kind of ratings would Sanders have gotten if he'd gotten even half the coverage of Clinton and Trump?
Well, yeah, I think there's a couple of things going on here. I do think that Bernie Sanders probably wouldn't have gotten the same kind of ratings that Donald Trump would, just because Donald Trump, he's a great reality show character. He's good at this. I mean, he's a television performer. Bernie isn't. You know, his politics are very popular, but he's not a crossover phenomenon into people who don't care about politics. Trump attracted the attention of people who couldn't stand him. People who tuned in just to watch what crazy nutty thing you would say next.
And we got manipulated by our own Schadenfreude.
Yeah, of course. Now, had Bernie gotten more coverage, would he have been more popular? Would he have gotten more votes? Would he have begun to attract ratings? Absolutely, because there are some storylines that are attractive in terms of selling the news. If they had pitched this as, you know, a successful revolution against the democratic establishment, I think that would have gotten a lot of ratings. I think, and you know, Bernie could have done something with that. But he's seen as being too political in the wrong ways by people in the news business, and that's why they didn't give him unlimited airtime, not even on the Democratic leading networks.
And then there's socialism. Well, now let me turn the focus just a little bit to the right. Was Clinton perceived by the press corps as maybe a boring insider, a whiner demanding her turn?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things going on with Hillary Clinton. You know, first of all, she had a very contentious relationship with the media. She didn't talk to the media. You know, so similar to Donald Trump, there wasn't a whole lot of access to the candidate. And, you know, you have to contrast this to, for instance, Barack Obama's 2008 campaign, where the reporters were falling over each other to praise the candidate. And he had lots and lots of off-the-record interaction with the press. He seemed to enjoy hanging around with them. Hillary didn't have that. Obviously, she had a long and bitter experience with the media dating back to her days in the White House with her husband, and I think that impacted the coverage for sure. But I think beyond that, there was a narrative that was true, which was that she had a lot of people out there who just saw her as being part of a system that they were very anxious to reject, and that was why they liked Trump. Trump, for all of his faults, he just wasn't part of this thing that they wanted to get out of power, and Hillary they saw as a symbol of that thing.
KBOO Portland, this is Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell speaking with Matt Taibbi, author of Insane Clown President. Well, it reminds me, I went to Philadelphia thanks to people who put up the money for me to fly there here in Portland. And I covered the street reaction, and I found Sanders supporters just exploding with electricity all over downtown. I couldn't believe it. I stuck to the City Hall area because it was just amazing to see all these people talking about democracy in various ways. But to find a Clinton supporter, I had to sort of nervously schlep myself, you know, make sure I didn't have too much lint on my shoulders, into a major hotel where it was so much quieter and people weren't really talking, and there were the Clinton people. Do you think the Democratic Party has learned from this fiasco, or are they likely to?
No. Do you?
not from what I can see so far, no.
Yeah, no. If you listen to the post-electoral, you know, autopsies on what happened, everybody's talking about James Comey, Russia, the media. You know, they should be sitting down somewhere in Washington, and you know they should be weeping and pounding, you know, half-gallon drums of ice cream and drowning their sorrows, and trying to figure out what they did wrong to lose a popularity contest. I understand that they won the popular vote, but this thing shouldn't have been within 20 million votes. I mean, Trump was a totally unqualified candidate who openly insulted every major demographic except for white, angry men. They should have cruised to the election, and the fact that they should be asking themselves what's wrong with our message? What are we not selling to people that they're not buying? You know, and I don't know about you, but I don't see them taking that step to ask themselves that question.
I'm going to quote from page 189 of Insane Clown President. You wrote, from the Walter Mondale years on. Ooh. Democrats have eaten from the same trough as Republicans. They've grown fat off cash from behemoths like Cisco, Pfizer, ExxonMobil, Citigroup, Goldman, and countless others, companies that move jobs overseas, offshore profits, help finance the construction of factories in rival states like China and India, and sometimes all of the above. So it's not a secret, is it? And
no, and they've always believed that they could kind of split the difference, right? That the, you know, the Bill Clinton formula, which worked brilliantly in 82 and 96, was we're going to take the money, we're going to embrace a quote-unquote business-friendly domestic economic policy, we're going to remain socially liberal, and that's going to be enough to keep all of our people in the fold, and it's going to allow us to compete financially with Republicans in terms of things like ad buys and so on. And look, it makes sense when you sit down in a K Street office in Washington and draw it up as a strategy. where it fails is when you go out to, you know, failing factory towns across the Rust Belt and you ask people what they think about that. And, you know, things have changed in the last 30 years. People are pissed. They want their jobs back. They want something different. And the Democratic Party, it wasn't in tune with that.
So much to say about that. I guess I want to shift again, though, and talk about journalistic standards. A couple of things made me think about this. One is, it's the anniversary of the Apollo fire, in which in the space race, the United States tried to was testing its first Apollo rocket, and there was a fire. And almost everything in the press coverage, I think, is probably correct, because it's not a particularly political thing now. But there's one thing that's always been left out, and I just use this as an indicator. I happened to be watching because I was an 8-year-old space fanatic. I lived in Houston, Texas. I was watching local Houston television. The fire started. One of the astronauts got the hatch open, waved frantically as he burned to death. I'm an 8-year-old watching this, and slumped like a rag doll. And I started crying, and that has been erased from history. And so I want to put that out to the press corps. Certain things can still be erased. And then I want to contrast that with, it seems that journalism, you know, just the camera can still be very, very useful. And I was talking about that Washington Post interview. I challenge any Trump fanatic to pull up that interview and keep your eyes steady on that venal man's face and the contortions, the rage, as you've mentioned, that he exhibits. I mean, I can see why he didn't give interviews. So,
right. Yeah.
I mean, let me throw in another one just to get you talking about this. Mateen Shaheed, the one-man riot here in Portland during the Trump so-called riots, smashed many, many car windows, car windshields. He smashed other windows. He set fires because he was angry at his girlfriend. But now it is known, and I put that word in scare quotes, across the world, thank you, sloppy journalists, wherever you are, that Portland protesters smashed the windshields to protest Trump.
Right.
I mean, it ain't true. It was one guy.
Right. Yeah. Well.
So what can journalists do now?
Well, it's hard because right now the way the media landscape works is that there's always going to be somebody who's going to put everything out there, and people are going to gravitate towards whatever facts that they like, and they're going to ignore the ones that they don't like. And so if there's a picture somewhere of a lefty protester doing something untoward, that's going to rocket around the internet and get a gazillion hits among a certain crowd. If you have Madonna talking about blowing up the White House or thinking about it, that's going to be endlessly repeated. And,
oh, you know, that's good. I missed that.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, a million people marching peacefully, that doesn't get on the news as much in those same circles. So we keep conscious of the fact that in the modern media atmosphere, everything is live all the time. Everyone's on camera. Everything you say might end up being a factor in a news story. And the media is, it's more organic than it used to be. It's not like in the old days when CBS, NBC, and ABC, you know, there were three networks that basically decided what people were going to emphasize in the press. Nowadays, you know, even if the major media companies ignore something, it can become a huge story elsewhere. So it's just a new landscape that we're in, and it's hard to navigate.
I'm going to be reading more of the book just to please myself, to read those characterizations that you put in there that are, I think it's good. Good. I mean, we can go ahead and laugh. I think we won't forget to be horrified. Insane Clown President is the book, and Matt Taibbi is the author. You're listening to KBOO Portland. So I want to talk about what's going on right now in these first few days of the Trump presidency. Trump has called Chelsea Manning a traitor. And the interesting thing is that he tweeted exactly what Fox News, maybe notice this.
Yeah.
Fox News put out something on their banner 14 minutes later, and this happened twice, two different phrases. 14 minutes later, Trump put out that Chelsea Manning was an ungrateful traitor. Do you think that Trump will go after her? Do you think he's that connected to Fox News?
Well, I don't know how he can. I guess unless there's a different charge, because Jeopardy's attached and she's been pardoned. So She was already convicted, so I guess they could try a different charge.
Wouldn't that be double jeopardy? I need a lawyer on here, I guess.
Well, I mean, I don't even remember what the original conviction was for, but you know, it wasn't for treason. I'm pretty sure. So, you know, there are lots of different charges, and they could always file something that's related, but not quite the same. So, but I would think it would be difficult for them to do that, and that's. But Trump is ignorant enough that I'm sure that he could try, and we wouldn't put it past him to do that. Also, it's just notable that he's openly taking his cues from news organizations, not just Fox, but the investigation into the supposed voter fraud, that's directly from an Alex Jones InfoWars story, and Alex Jones himself got it from some nut job named, I think it was Jay Phillips, who is totally unsourced. So, you know, Trump is like launching presidential initiatives based on unsourced crazy news reports, which is, you know, disturbing beyond belief.
From MSM, four more journalists have been charged with felonies after being arrested while covering the unrest around Donald Trump's inauguration, meaning that at least six media workers are facing up to 10 years in prison and $25,000 fine if convicted. A documentary producer, a photojournalist, a live streamer, and a freelance reporter were each charged with the most serious level of offense under DC's law against rioting after being caught up in the police action against demonstrators. Your comments?
Yeah, that's very upsetting. There have been a number of indications, you know, dating back a while now that the attitude towards the press is changing. I would say that even the Chelsea Manning episode originally signaled to reporters that there was a possibility that working with a whistleblower might end up landing you a criminal charge. And that had a chilling effect on a lot of people. I know I talked to a lot of people in the business. Trump, of course, is going to take it a step further. And I would not be surprised if they somehow find a way to politicize and make journalists culpable for simply being involved in episodes that are displeasing to them.
You point out in the book that the Obama administration has neatly set up things for authoritarian rule and didn't get an objection to it at the time. Thing that stays in my mind, of course, is the 2012 addition to the National Defense Authorization, which pretty much destroyed habeas corpus and says anyone can be snatched from anywhere, anytime, and never given up.
Right.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, no, this is in the book. You know, I talked about how there were a lot of people, a lot of liberals in America who didn't protest when the Obama administration vastly expanded executive authority and made moves in an authoritarian direction that were a continuation of what went on that began in the Bush years. And now we're seeing what happens. You know, the idea that expanding presidential authority is okay when somebody we like is in office, that's terrible, because the whole idea is to think about the worst case scenario, which is somebody like Donald Trump. And now we have a president who's openly advocating not just enhanced interrogation, torture. He even used that word. And that's on us, because we didn't protest enough when this started, you know, 12 years ago or continued during the Obama years.
That face. Advocating
torture.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. That's the emoji right there.
Yeah. Well, I got a note from a listener who called in. And by the way, would you like to take listener calls?
Sure.
Okay. Listener called in and asks, what about Trump's ties to organized crime? If you're calling in, the number is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. The question is, what about Trump's ties to organized crime? And I'm here with Matt Taibbi, author of Insane Clown President.
You know, honestly, I'm going to have to punt on that one because I don't know a whole lot about it. My former boss, who sadly died last week, Wayne Barrett, who was the first Trump biographer, he was very interested in that question. But you know, I don't know what they've ever really uncovered in that score. Obviously, he's done a lot of business in in Atlantic City, there are a lot of tales about his relations with unions and construction contracts in that city. But you know, I don't have anything concrete, and I don't know that anything that has ever been uncovered.
Okay, then I will change the subject somewhat. Trump is starting off in flames with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, who, according to Politico, is steadfast in his promise that his nation, Mexico, won't pay for a wall along America's southern border. And Trump is saying then it's better to cancel the upcoming meeting. I'm alarmed to read that, of course, because this is a president. This is diplomacy. And it reminds me of Naomi Klein's warning about shock doctrine and paraphrasing Milton Friedman, that a new administration has 60 to 90 days, is it? Or 3 to 6 months or something like that. It's a short amount of time to establish the new normal. Can you comment on that?
Sure. And what's happening now with his relations with foreign countries is incredibly upsetting. And again, this just gets back to the whole idea that this is a person who couldn't shrug off Meryl Streep when she gives a speech at the Golden Globe. So what's going to happen when he feels personally slighted by somebody who is the head of a foreign state, and either an important ally or a potential military enemy? Trump, diplomacy is not personal. It never should be. Geopolitics is something that is all about nations and economics. Trump is going to personalize this, and he's going to see this issue, like for instance with the wall, he's going to see this as a repudiation of a campaign promise, and that somebody's going to try to show him up. Whereas in reality, it's just a foreign leader trying to protect the interests of his own nation, and Trump is incapable psychologically of understanding that distinction, and that's what's so disturbing about him as a leader.
You think he's off the leash already? Should we be calling Bannon?
I don't believe that there are puppet strings attached to Donald Trump. I mean, again, I hate to keep harping on this, but the tweeting. If there was actually a grown up in the room, Donald Trump would not be tweeting. The president would not be putting out his unvarnished thoughts onto social media. They would be sitting down and with calculation messaging the public, which is what you do if you're the head of the world's biggest corporation, which is what essentially the United States government is. Trump is acting like it's a wholly owned private company, and he doesn't understand the distinction between representing the collective interests of an entire nation and him being an individual and what his individual interests are. It's not even that he doesn't recognize that difference. It's that he doesn't understand that there is a difference, and that's what's so worrying.
Oh my God, you're scaring me. Well, the number to call is 503-231-8187. We have callers on the line. If you'd like to speak with Matt Taibbi, co-editor, is that the right phrase? Contributing editor, that's the phrase. Rolling Stone, author of Insane Clown President. The number to call, 503-231-8187. And Sean is on the air.
Mr. Taibbi, I'm still obsessed with the events of 2007, 2008 on Wall Street. Reagan revolution was carried out with a kind of quasi-libertarian, laissez-faire capitalist explanation. I'm just completely blown away with Donald Trump picking winners and losers in the marketplace, completely violating all the tenets of the free market capitalist system, and these little toadies like Stephen Moore and Larry Kudlow kind of cheering him along. As he goes, the flagrant contradiction, the total subjective reality. I mean, this is pure fascism. When they're not even adhering to their own logic, to their own arguments, they're completely off the rails intellectually. Could you comment on any of that? The fascist tendency.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's a great question. I talk about this in the book, and I think it's an important point for people to understand that. The laissez-faire capitalism, the libertarianism, you have to remember that that was a political idea that was very important to who in particular. The donors that were backing people like Ronald Reagan. Now, Reagan, of course, intellectually also believed that, but what was important was the people who were most enthusiastic about those ideas were the gigantic industrial powers that wanted less regulation and wanted to pay less taxes, and it was sold to the ordinary person as the personal liberty argument. And they went along with it, but Donald Trump sort of brilliantly understood that they were never really emotionally, like the Republican voter was never really emotionally attached to those concepts. I think that they were much more persuaded by the politics of resentment, by politics of class, the idea that there are people in New York and Washington and L.A. and in Hollywood who look down on ordinary people. And they have disdain for you know the middle class person, the cop, the fireman, the person in the military. Those were the driving ideas, that and the xenophobia, the idea that we have to keep the bad people out from infecting our great culture. Trump replaced the economic argument with the cultural argument, and that's why we're seeing this contradiction now. And I think there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who are just going along for the ride because they don't know what else to do politically.
All right. Well, you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch. I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, author of Insane Clown President. And coming up this morning on KBOO at 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary at 10:15. It's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11 on Between the Covers, hear from Portland author James Anderson about his mystery novel, The Never Open Dessert Diner. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures welcomes three directors of short films that will be screened at the upcoming 40th Annual Portland Film Festival. And I'd like to thank KBOO members for your generous support. Not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And I've been speaking with Matt Taibbi. And that reminds me, actually, with our journalism. Here at KBOO, we are, I think we're kind of moving towards a model in which we get money directly from the public. Of course, we've always been that way. We get our money directly, but I mean, our journalism, we are looking at trying to replace the fact that journalism isn't profitable by going to directly publicly funded journalism. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly the profit model was a huge factor in this election. Again, this is also something I talk about in the book. In the old days, the major networks understood that news was basically a loss leader. The Telecommunications Act, I think it was 1938, sort of set out that you can use the public airwaves, but you have to use them in the quote-unquote public interest and convenience. So there was a sort of unspoken agreement that networks could make money, but they had to also provide a public service. And the public service has always been, we're going to do news and we're not going to worry about making money doing it. And we're going to act with some degree of ethics when we do it. Problem this time around is that, you know, that we've stopped believing that. You know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, we stopped believing that. And it's become about making money. And that leads to situations where we can't take the cameras off Donald Trump because he's making us money. So it's a problem. And I don't know what we can do about it. This is a capitalist economy still. And it's going to be difficult to get us away from that model. You know, I mean, I think the steps that you're taking are great, but it's still very hard to do. And I don't know what the obvious solution is.
It's working for us though. I must say, we are expanding. People, I think, are tuning in and turning on to this. I mentioned that I get Rolling Stone. It's the only print magazine I get. I'm really not interested in their ads for people making 100 and 1,000 times as much as I do annually. I want to read Matt Taibbi. So I get Rolling Stone, and so that makes you a standout. It's like, you know, you got to read that because, you know, you're in there. But I would view it as an exception. And I mentioned Washington Post earlier. I'm certainly glad they're still there, and I'm glad they kept the camera on him. This brings us back to what is truth? Is truth, can we keep truth as a standard. Tyler Cohen wrote recently, one of the most striking features of the early Trump administration has been its political use of lying. The big weekend story was obviously the false claim, and going back to Donald Trump's press secretary, Sean Spicer, that Trump pulled in the largest inauguration crowds in American history. And I don't want to hash over all of that once again. But given the circumstances, what can journalism do about this obvious misdirection? Can we just keep shouting that he's lying? Do we make lists of the lies and repeat them every day?
I mean, I understand the imperative to call a lie a lie, and to put the words like lie in the headlines. But I worry about that too. There's been the reaction to Trump has been so extreme that people are beginning to ask the media to have more of an impact than I think we're supposed to have. I think our job is supposed to be pretty limited to just kind of calling it as we see it. And when we start emotionally responding to provocations like Trump's, and then we fall into the trap where he gets to portray us as almost like characters in one of his wrestling dramas, like that we're like this evil force that is always against him. I think just sort of with a detached, dispassionate, just reporting of the facts. And I know that's ridiculous for somebody who just wrote a book with the title I wrote to say, I think at this moment, we in the media, we actually have to focus more on just sort of calling it as we see it in every conceivable direction, where as opposed to just focusing all of our efforts on stopping Donald Trump or anything like that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like,
I think I do. It could go too far. Well, Joe is waiting to talk with you. Let's talk with Joe. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Hello, Joe. You're on the air with Matt Taibbi.
I'm going to go out and get the book, but I just wonder, is there anything in the book about how allegedly his helicopter pilot, or one of his helicopter pilots, had something to do with flying in the good old nose candy?
Thanks, Joe, for the question. I did not put that in the book. I actually got in a little trouble for hinting at that during one of the early debate performances. So I had some friends who were tweeting out the Chappelle clips of Rick James talking about how cocaine was a hell of a drug during the debate. It's tough to write about stuff like that. Even if you have suspicions, you just can't do it without absolutely knowing.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Well, we're getting towards the top of the hour here. I'm talking with Matt Taibbi, Insane Clown President, and you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Matt, do you have any concluding thoughts about your book, Insane Clown President?
It's a book about how we got here. I mean, I think they asked me before we went to press, how do you sum this up in one sentence for people? At a time when everybody's really bummed out about a lot of people are bummed out about Trump being president, I think this book will do is make sense of it a little bit for people who don't understand how we got here. And hopefully allow people to have a little bit of a laugh, on some level about the absurdity of it all. I did think it was going to be just a self-contained story about a moment of temporary insanity. It turned out to be just the beginning of something. So I think it's still worth telling the story, the amazing story of how we got here. And that's what this is.
It's permanent insanity. Well, it reminds me of what I do. If I'm not reading your book and I'm reading press articles about Trump and they're hard to avoid and I'm getting down, I turn to YouTube and I put up Spike Jones recording from the 40s of "When Der Führer says we are the master race," then we say "Heil, Heil," right in Der Führer's face. The name of it is Der Führer's face, and it just makes me feel better. So I think I'll leave it with that. Matt Taibbi, thank you so much for joining me for an interview here on KBOO Portland. It's been a gas, and I know your book is selling well, and good luck with that.
Appreciate it. All right, take care. Thank you so much for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. We're broadcasting at 90.7 FM from our beautiful Eiffel Tower on the hill, which happens to be painted red and white so the airplanes don't run into it. And we're broadcasting at other frequencies in the near Cascadia area. We are on KBOO.FM, where you can get this show. Goes up about 15 minutes after we sign off the air. And you can get it on KBOO.FM, where you can contribute. KBOO.FM, where we go out to all the ships at sea.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll have Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Join us for your daily news magazine. At 11 on Between the Covers, you can hear from Portland author James Anderson about his mystery novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. And at 11:30, The Film Show welcomes three directors of short films that will be screened at the upcoming Portland Annual Portland Film Festival. That is all coming up. But first, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary right after this.
Listen to The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of each month at 11:30 a.m. The Film Show features news and interviews about the local and independent film scene. That's The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of the month at 11:30 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
Cascadia. Today is Thursday, January 26, 2017, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at your sanctuary radio.